Good morning. I'm Bob Cook, and I'm here representing CAPE. On the screen behind me is the list of the lecturers for this semester, and you are invited to return for some of those, any of those. The fourth one is on the acoustics of whales, which didn't get added to my slide, but is now in place. Ken King is our speaker. And it's going to be on the origin and history of the internet. And I should say a couple of things of context setting. One is that it is the political history of the internet, not the development of the hardware, not the development of the software per se, but it's the grand scheme for how the internet came, coalesced, and began functioning. It also emphasizes the role of the university, which has been neglected in all of the hype. And I'm going to give you a little bit of background of the credentials of the speaker so you'll have a context for understanding his experience. Education is a bachelor's degree at Reed, Phi Beta Kappa, then a PhD in theoretical physics at Columbia. He was teaching in electrical engineering at the time he was doing his thesis work. He has became, immediately after completing his degree, became director of the Computing Center at Columbia and was there during a very politically turbulent period. He became University Dean for Computing, and then he went to the City University of New York and became a vice chancellor. My contact with him started in 1980. He was at Cornell from 80 to 87, and I'll say a bit more about that in just a moment. He left here to go to Educom, which is a higher education computing group, and then he also served as executive director of the Corporation for Research and Educational Networking. And he's now retired, living here again in Ithaca. His professional activities, selected set, he was a member of BitNet back 83, way back to 83. That's almost prehistoric times. He was co-founder of NicerNet. At Cornell, he was the co-principal investigator for the supercomputer, and Cornell was in that first wave of universities going for the super large computer. He was co-founder of the important Educom Networking and Telecommunications Task Force. And he was a member and chair of the Federal Networking Council Advisory Committee. He was founder of the Common Solutions Group. That's a group of leadership people in computing, very influential. He, in 92-93, was a member of the Internet Society Board of Trustees, and you'll see more about that in his talk. And he also was co-founder for the Internet First University Press. Now, a bit about his Cornell experience. And as Ken's quote of Yogi Berra, you can also learn a lot just by watching. When he came here in 80, we were in the midst of an enormous crisis. The computing really was leaderless. And there was a lot of chaos. When Ken came, and this was an example of very shrewd political leadership, he came and spent 2 weeks, took a two-week leave from his job at City University, came here and interviewed everyone on this campus who had anything, any serious interest in computing. And he had the intellectual capacity to understand what he heard and wrote a report and presented it to Provost Kennedy and said, if you want me, this is what we should do. And implicit was, if you don't want to do this, then you still have some more searching to do. But the shrewdness of it was that all of his political battles, all of the big ones, like moving the computer from Langmuir Lab onto campus, had already been settled. He knew the lay of the land and knew what was going to happen, and so the political bloodletting was not going to happen. He also turned around the management strategy here Cornell had bought the biggest computer it could afford to buy just before the 80s, because there were faculty who really needed it. And so we proceeded to fine-tune it, the operating system, to get as much capacity out of it as we could. And because we tampered with the operating system and the interface to the hard disk drives and other pieces of equipment, when the prices dropped for replacements, Cornell couldn't adopt them because we had painted ourselves into a corner. And Ken had the foresight to understand that if you had the leadership capacity and operated at the front end of the cycle, and you bought them as soon as they hit the market and you sold them while they still had a resale value, you could enormously drop your cost of computing. And that the cost of equipment has continued, so it was a very shrewd move. There was a massive paradigm shift from central computing to decentralization. Ken was here in the time that the microcomputer arrived, and we had a consortium deal with Apple and Project Ezra, $8 or $9 million gift from IBM, and we went from a handful of faculty being interested in computing to nearly everyone who had any interest in computing having equipment and software to work with. So it was a massive upheaval. And as a result, Cornell faculty became active and national participants in the software development. And finally, the supercomputing and networking, along with Ken Wilson, he realized that it was very, very important for us to be able to communicate beyond the boundaries of the campus. So let me now turn the floor to Ken King, frankly one of my personal heroes, and who has contributed enormously to this university. It's yours.
Thank you, Bob. Some years ago in Provincetown, I saw a lady, and on the back of her t-shirt were inscribed the words which I think accurately describe the challenges of large-scale technological ventures. It said, "If we can put a man on the moon, why don't we put all of them there?" In this narrative, I will interweave events in my own career as they relate to relevant future events or my perspective on those events, but there were many parts to the internet elephant, and I will primarily describe only the parts that I saw. In the early 1960s, network terminals began to replace key punches, enabling time sharing and online program editors. But networking was hard because the telephone company owned all the wire on campus. And online program editors enabled people to edit a program which was stored online and submit it to the batch and get some output back from the computer after the program had been run. And in the middle 60s, host-based email systems were developed primarily to surmount the lack of voice messaging answering systems. It was also the dawn of the age of social media. An online program editor at Columbia University was repurposed to support a primitive precursor to Facebook by the gay community at Columbia. People could friend someone by giving them the magic word that was used to encrypt and decrypt an online file. And it supported a blog and a dating service. And there was some evidence that it was in use by SDS during the Troubles, and if that was the case, it was an early example of the use of social media to plot a revolution. And at that time, computer literacy became an important issue. Computer languages combining mathematics and logic enabled the description and analysis of complex systems without ambiguity, and computer programs capture intelligence that can be applied to broad classes of problems. Linguists are fond of pointing out that as simple a sentence as "Mary had a little lamb" can mean "Mary owned a little lamb," "Mary gave birth to a little lamb," Mary had sex with a little lamb. And mathematics was a way of describing relatively simple systems without ambiguity. But if you could combine mathematics and logic with a computer, you could describe and analyze vastly more complex systems. And just as a person who didn't understand mathematics was mathematically illiterate, I mean, we said someone who didn't understand how to use computer programs and computers was computer illiterate. And there was a problem of infusing computing into the curriculum, and creating computer science departments became important, and faculty computer literacy across all disciplines became important because the faculty defined the role of computing in their discipline. However, this was a hard sell at some universities. At Columbia, a colleague of mine and I wrote a letter to the provost describing the importance of computer literacy and suggesting that the university consider creating a computer science department. And we got a two-sentence response. He said, how can you create a science around an instrument? If computer science, why not X-ray science? And I heard that he reported this exchange to a lot of his colleagues, and his punchline always got a good laugh. And it was also the start of the mini computer and mainframe wars. Universities wanted research dollars to help fund expensive mainframes. Faculty wanted computer resources that they controlled and did not want to pay for time by the millisecond. And suppressing mini computers hurt faculty computer literacy. In the late 1960s, ARPANET was started, connecting four universities in the West. It was designed as a military communication system and as a mechanism for sharing unused computer cycles around the network. Network-based email became a killer app, and the transmission program evolved to employ packet switching and was called TCP/IP. And it turned out that people did not want to share computer cycles on other computers around the network, but they did want to talk. And because the usual trade-off at that time was that on the one hand, computers were very expensive, but on the other hand, they were not very reliable, they designed the system so that messages were broken into packets, and the packets swam through the network, and if there was any path to their destination, they found it, and then they got reassembled. In 1971, there was a large federal research funding cutback, creating financial problems at Columbia University. And Columbia wisely decided to protect academic programs and impose deep cuts on administrative and support services. So I was faced with the necessity of firing a significant number of people on my staff at the Computer Center. At the same time, I got a call from CUNY telling me that CUNY was about to start open admissions and they expected total student enrollment to grow north of 275,000 in their 8 colleges, and they had a primitive computing infrastructure and they wanted me to come and build a computing infrastructure that was state of the art. I saw a path to avoid firing a significant number of people on my staff. I could go to CUNY and take with me the people that I would have had to fire at Columbia. However, before accepting the job offer, I did my due diligence. New York City had an office which approved all computing decisions. Above the door of that office, there was a sign that read, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." Before agreeing to accept their job offer, I got budgetary sign-off from the office of the mayor of New York City on a plan to build a large central computer center connected to smaller computers in the colleges and a plan to push computer literacy. The CUNY Central Computer Center created by this sign-off will figure in the future, in the narrative of future events. And key staff members from Columbia followed me to CUNY, and among them was Ira Fuchs, who I appointed as director of the Central CUNY Computer Center, and his name will occur again. By the late 1970s, I had concluded that mainframe-centric computing could never involve more than 20% of the faculty in computing, and the introduction of microcomputers opened a new path to infusing computing broadly into the curriculum. In the late 70s, after the city of New York went broke, funding of the Senior College of CUNY were taken over by the state, and the state had an office in Albany for approving all computer decisions, and above the door of that office there was a sign. In 1980, Cornell invited me to an interview, and I had not heard good things about computing at Cornell, but I was picked up at the airport by Bob Cook, and by the time we reached the one-lane bridge on our way to the campus, I recognized him as a kindred spirit. I mean, he told me that he had convinced the provost to start a decentralized computing group. And in those days, most universities were still fighting decentralized computers, and there were some that tolerated it, but very few were supporting it. And by the time we crossed the one-lane bridge, my attitude toward the Cornell interview had changed 180 degrees. I had three conditions. Let's see, before agreeing to accept a job offer, I got sign-off on a plan to improve computing at Cornell, as Bob said, and two other conditions. One, that the computer center move back from Langmuir to the campus, and two, that I report to the provost. At City University, I was probably the first university computer executive to report above the level of buildings and grounds. And my office was two doors down from the chancellor's, and I found that very useful. So Cornell committed to an aggressive expansion of its computer infrastructure in support of research and infusing computing into the curriculum, and I accepted a job. In 1981, TCPIP migrated to Unix at the University of California at Berkeley, and from there to Unix systems in computer science departments across the country. In 1975, Ken Thompson, who was one of the co-authors of Unix, had a sabbatical year at the University of California at Berkeley, and he brought Unix with him, and the computer science faculty packaged Unix as Berkeley Unix and improved it over time, and they distributed it broadly to computer science departments around the country. And in 1981, a graduate student named Bill Joy put TCPIP into Unix, and shortly after that, he became co-founder of the Sun Computer Company. And the fact that TCPIP was now in Unix became important. And in 1981, two critical ventures for the future of networking, BitNet and Computer Science Net, were started. Computer Science Net was based on Unix and TCPIP, and it grew to connect 84 computer science departments, including one in Israel. And it developed the networking technology that was used in NSFNet. BitNet. Ira Fuchs, who had succeeded me as vice chancellor for university systems at CUNY, learned from a former colleague at the Columbia Computer Center, now at IBM Research, that the solution to the problem of turning host-based email systems into network-based email systems had been hiding in plain sight, and it was very inexpensive. It simply required repurposing an existing program. IBM had developed a protocol called RSCS, which sent a print queue from one computer to a remote computer's print queue over at least 9600 baud telephone line. And this program could send a print queue from one computer to any other computer connected in a tree structure. And it was basically used to send print output from a mainframe to a small remote computer to avoid the problem of transporting printout by truck. But it supported transmitting the print output to any remote computer in a tree structure. Someone realized that, looked at as a string of bits, there was no difference between a message queue and a print queue. Computers were too dumb in those days to know the difference. And to IRC, the terminals all over the world looked like remote printers. Ira Fuchs immediately started an effort to persuade universities to link their email systems, and BitNet was started when Yale leased the line connecting its computer to the CUNY Computer Center. Cornell was the sixth university to connect, and the network grew rapidly. Any computer connected in a tree structure could send email and data files to any other computer in that structure, and at the top of the BitNet tree was the CUNY Computer Center. BitNet later added instant messages and list servers to its capabilities. An immediate BitNet economic benefit was that it enabled university systems programmers to collaborate on fixing system bugs, creating system enhancements, and fighting hackers. System crashes caused large economic losses. And you probably would not be surprised to hear that new releases of the operating system in those days contained lots of bugs. And universities, having a very diverse range of users, were generally the first place to find these bugs. And when a system crashed, a mainframe crashed, it would take something like a half hour to reboot it. And if the source of the crash had not been identified and the computer came back up, it would crash again. And this wasted a lot of time of people who were waiting for their output, and it was not unusual for some of them to start chanting at computer center staff, "It's all your fault. It's all your fault." Except that couldn't happen at Cornell because the staff was out at the airport. Although some people said that they thought they heard that chant all the way from the campus to the airport, and that would not surprise me. So what motivated Yale to connect to CUNY? And I suspect it was not because Yale faculty had a burning interest to talk to CUNY faculty. In fact, most faculty didn't have terminals on their desk. But systems programmers had a burning interest to talk to each other. And in particular, City University at that time had a world-class systems group. The core group that I had brought from Columbia to City University. And so systems programmers had a burning interest to talk to each other. And I think that was the interest that powered the early growth of BitNet. And as it grew, Ira got a grant from IBM to create a BitNet support center, and I talked Ira into putting that support center at EDUCOM, which was a higher education association devoted to improving academic computing. And the first European University Connect was University College Dublin in Ireland. IBM funded the line to Dublin from CUNY and additional lines from Dublin to a number of other European countries, and this created a BitNet network in Europe called ERN. And the director of the University College Dublin Computer Center was Dennis Jennings, who in 1985 became responsible for networking at the NSF. BitNet grew to connect more than 500 institutions in 49 countries, including the Soviet Union. It supported all disciplines, faculty, students, and staff, and it was entirely funded by universities. BitNet launched a large increase in scholarly collaboration across institutions as microcomputers connected to a campus network began to appear on faculty desks. And BitNet proved the value of networking to higher education, and BitNet motivated universities to build a networking support staff and to rewire their campus. In 1992, Ken Wilson won the Nobel Prize in Physics, and Ken became a national advocate for supercomputing. There were other voices, but his was the loudest. Starting in the early 1980s, microcomputer labs spread across the Cornell campus. Microcomputers supported terminal emulation, email, word processing, spreadsheets, and mathematical and statistical applications. And the faculty discovered that equipped with a microcomputer, it was easier to edit their own papers than to rely on a secretary. In 1984, the Congress appropriated $200 million to start a national competition to create four national supercomputer centers. And in 1984, Project Ezra was launched. IBM granted Cornell a $9 million grant, fungible in terms of IBM PCs, and any faculty member could get a PC in return for a commitment to use the computing in a course that they taught. Campus rewiring started to accommodate a Cornell-owned telephone switch. The Cornell Computer Center moved from the airport to the campus to a computing and communications center, thus fulfilling a promise Keith Kennedy had made to me when I took the job. In 1985, Cornell is wired. All the microcomputers located on campus and in the residence halls could now be networked with Cornell wire. And a few years ago, Bill Gates was on campus, and in his talk, he said that Microsoft first learned about networking when an employee who was a Cornell graduate returned from the campus and announced, "Cornell is wired." 1985, a snowstorm in New Haven, the velocity of light, and the grand challenges of science. I was invited by IBM to talk to a group of colleges in New Haven about Project Ezra. They had funded a number of these projects, but Cornell had far and away the most aggressive project. And a snowstorm canceled my flight back to Ithaca. And as the conference broke up, Carl Ledbetter appeared and asked me if I had a little time to talk about an idea that he was noodling about. And at the time, I had nothing but time. Thinking inside and outside the box, Carl suggested that IBM might be persuaded to collaborate with Cornell on a Cornell supercomputer proposal based on an architecture consisting of an IBM mainframe to which some number of floating point systems boxes were channel attached. It would be the only supercomputer in the competition based on parallel processing. And at the time, Cornell had a floating point systems box attached to its mainframe, and this hardware was made by a small company in Oregon, and it was basically a Fortran engine, and you downloaded programs from the mainframe across a channel to the computer, and the computer chugged away quietly in the corner, sometimes for days, and then spooled its output back to the mainframe for storage or printing. If a problem could be partitioned in a way that enabled a number of FPS boxes to work on it in parallel, this architecture had aggregate power in the supercomputer range. And regret to tell you that the supercomputer range in those days had less power than the computer that's sitting in front of me today. And parallel computing was a challenge because the problem had to be broken into parts, and there was some programming complexity. A computer designer's lament: the velocity of light limits the speed of a uniprocessor. In the days of discrete components, that was a very severe limitation. And some years earlier, an engineer at IBM had told me that he wished that instead of resting on the seventh day, God would have worked on a better velocity of light. But physicists subsequently discovered that if the velocity of light had been only slightly faster, that the Big Bang would have aborted into a black hole. So the velocity of light was in fact perfect at the end of the sixth day. The wave of the future. Because the velocity of light is finite, the equations of physics are amenable to massively parallel computation. And I had written a paper as a graduate student at Columbia that was related to that. And massively parallel processing was the only hope for solving the grand challenges of science, and there was a list of them at that time, and on that list was decoding the human genome and climate and weather analysis programs. So I'm enthusiastic about this idea, and we agree on an equitable division of labor. Carl will go back to IBM and try to convince them to donate their biggest mainframe and a full complement of peripherals to a Cornell proposal. And I agreed to go back to Cornell to try to persuade Cornell to submit a proposal based on this architecture. And as we broke up, Carl said, when I report this conversation to my management, they'll probably say, Carl, how long have you worked for IBM, not counting the rest of today? So I came back to Cornell the next day, and I talked to Ken Wilson, and he was very enthusiastic about the idea. And I talked to Bob Barker, the provost, and he was very enthusiastic about the idea. So that in a short period of time, we generated a proposal about embodying this architecture with Ken Wilson and I as co-principal investigators, and we forwarded it to IBM. And they acknowledged receiving it and said that they would get back to us. But it got to be 2 days before the submission deadline, and we hadn't heard from them. So we called them, telling them that it was now or never, and a little after noon of that day, we got word that they would take a meeting with us at their Yorktown laboratory that afternoon. So I grabbed some blank foils and a felt-tip pen, and Wilson and Barker and I headed for the airport, and we chartered a flight to Poughkeepsie. And on that flight, I wrote out a presentation on the foils. And when we got to Yorktown, we were ushered into a conference room, and I asked for an overhead projector, was brought in. And then Ralph Gomery, who was the IBM vice president, the IBM director of research, and eight other senior staff members from the laboratory filed into the room and sat around the conference table. And they were followed by Carl Ledbetter, who was looking absolutely ashen, which I did not regard as a good sign. So I made a presentation with the foils. And the gist of that presentation was that parallel computing was the wave of the future, and that this would be the only parallel computing proposal in the competition at the NSF, and that it had aggregate computer power well into the supercomputer range, and that IBM could benefit by having a seat at the table where advanced applications and innovations took place. And when I finished, Gomery turned to the group and said, what do you think? And the first person to talk said, I think it's a terrible idea. He said IBM had gotten out of the supercomputer business some years earlier, so it had no commercial interest in this proposal, and it was very expensive, and it was high risk, and it could result in corporate embarrassment. And a couple of other people seated around the table agreed that it was high risk. But the five others' opinions range from it's an interesting idea that might be worth a try to it sounds like a good idea that is worth a try. And when they finished, Gomery immediately looked up and said, so we'll do it. you'll have a letter of commitment from us tomorrow morning. And we were in and out of that room in under a half hour. And as we left, we wondered what the hell had just happened. They asked us no questions. So the next day, a proposal from Cornell was hand-delivered to the NSF. And a couple of days before the NSF site visit, we had a dry run. And I played the role of the site visit committee, and the faculty and Wilson had obviously not prepared. And after the first faculty presenter finished his talk, I said, "Would you rather have a Cray?" And he immediately answered, "Yes." And I thought it was all up the smokestack. But 2 days later, when the site visit committee arrived, the day was absolutely magical. The faculty was articulate and highly supportive. Wilson was articulate on parallel computing being the wave of the future, and he had imported a parallel computing expert from England, and that expert told the committee that failure to advance parallel computing could lead to the end of civilization as we knew it. And when we won, Wilson immediately started creating the Theory Center, and I described the center to the Cornell Board of Trustees as the place at Cornell where the rubber met the sky. And Wilson liked that description a lot. But after we won, IBM said they wanted to negotiate an agreement which defined what I had meant when at Yorktown I had said that they would have a seat at the table. And it took some months to get that agreement. It was finally hammered out in the offices of IBM's top corporate attorney. And as we signed, he said, "Gentlemen, you have given us the sleeves to your vest." And shortly after that, IBM announced that its mainframes will be enhanced with a vectors capability. And the leader of that project was Carl Ledbetter. And a couple of years later, the president of IBM told me that as a result of the Cornell relationship, that effort had started. And as a result of that effort, they had sold a lot of computers that they would not otherwise have sold. And so the company had made a lot of money on the Cornell relationship. And I think I began to understand why Carl had been noodling in New Haven. The next problem was to create a network that enabled researchers to use the national supercomputer centers, and that created a protocol issue. Say, what protocol would be, transmission protocol would be used? And in my judgment, there were three possibilities. DECnet, which was a proprietary protocol of the Digital Equipment Corporation, and that protocol was in wide use by the physics community. OSI, which was a protocol developed as a standard, and it was working its way through an international standards committee at the pace of a pig through a python with, in my view, the same inevitable output. And there was TCP/IP, which was the protocol used in Computer Science Net, and that was the protocol that the networking community supported. And ever aware of Lenin's advice, influence is good, control is better, the university computer networking community was strongly behind TCP/IP. And I wondered if Wilson would be willing to go to the wall with the physics community if they pushed DECnet strongly. And I knew where he stood on this issue, because his wife managed the Unix project in computer services, and she was an ardent TCP/IP advocate. And I got my answer very quickly. Dennis Jennings reported that at a Science Advisory Committee meeting, Wilson had taken off his shoe, banged it on the table, and shouted, TCP/IP, TCP/IP, TCP/IP. And Jennings said that no one in the room had the foggiest idea what he was talking about except him. But this story got wide currency, and after that, we never heard peep out of the DECnet community. And a few years ago, a few years back, at a reunion of internet pioneers, Wilson and Jennings and I were on a panel, and Jennings brought up the shoe-banging episode. And Wilson admitted that at the time, he didn't have the foggiest idea what TCP/IP was either. So shortly after that, Jennings called a meeting at the National Center for Atmospheric Research of the leaders of the National Supercomputer Centers, and seated around a picnic table outdoors there, we architected a three-tier network to support access of users to supercomputer centers. And at the bottom level was a backbone network connecting the supercomputer centers. And at the next level, there were a regional network connecting universities to the backbone. And at the top level, there was the local area campus network. And when we finished that design, Dennis said, "And the transmission protocol?" And Wilson and I shouted, "TCP/IP," and with a broad Irish grin, Jennings said, "Done." He then said that he could appropriate $250,000 for the start of the backbone, and Cornell and University of Illinois, another supercomputer center, took responsibility for building it. And on the flight back from Boulder, I architected a network connecting the research universities in the state of New York. And the next day, I invited the leaders of those universities to a meeting at Cornell. And out of that meeting, NICERNet was created, New York State Education and Research Net, connecting universities in the state of New York to Cornell and Princeton. And at the same time, Doug Gale, who had been the director of decentralized computing, was now at the University of Nebraska, called a meeting and of research universities in the four states around Nebraska. And out of that meeting, MidNet was created. And BitNet and Computer Science Net people across the country collaborated. And in a short period of time, there was something like 28 regional networks covering the entire United States. But there was a flower ball in the gravy. NSFNet was called the NRN by the NSF, the National Research Network, and we wanted a network supporting all academic uses. And in my inner circle at the time, there was a political scientist with a high additional credential, and he came up with a solution to this problem. He said, "We need someone in DC to represent our interests, and we need to recruit a group of universities to share the cost." And that person was Douglas Van Howling, who had been director of academic computing when I came to Cornell, and he had a PhD in political science, and he was a member of the government department and at Cornell, and you can't have a higher credential than that when dealing with an issue like this. So in 1986, Doug Van Howling and I had an EDUCOM meeting, rounded up the people at the meeting who reported above the level of buildings and grounds. And we made our pitch, and we got three of them at that meeting to throw in with us. And we had 10 others, roughly 10 others, who were highly probable. And on the basis of that, we hired Mike Roberts, who had been director of telecommunications at Stanford, as the person to represent us. But as he arrived at EDUCOM, the president of EDUCOM resigned, and he was temporarily repurposed as acting president of EDUCOM. And the NTTF grew to 40 members representing the most prestigious universities in the country. And the NTTF members determined higher education's networking goals, priorities, and strategies. The NTTF became highly influential as the only organized group representing higher education in the networking area on the ground in DC. In 1987, I moved to EDUCOM as president, and the chair of the search committee is sitting a few rows back, Bill Arms. And that year, the NTTF also had its first success when the NSF permitted all academic users to use the NSF backbone, creating the NREN, the National Research and Education Network. And in 1988, when EDUCOM's lease in Princeton expired, it moved to Washington to L Street, close to K Street, but. And over time, the NTTF developed four goals for networking: connect every scholar in the world to every other scholar, surmounting the barriers of space and time to scholarly collaboration, and that was a BitNet goal; enable access from the network to all scholarly information worth sharing, and that's a goal that's still a work in progress, but a great leap forward occurred when Paul Ginspar created Archive; build a knowledge management system that enables scholars to surf through this sea of knowledge in a simple and intuitive way. Think Google, and if you watched Jeopardy last night, Watson. And enable the building of knowledge on a new dynamic multimedia platform in addition to building it on static information in print format. I mean, there's no way to understand a complex dynamic system without video images following what's going on. In physics, this is called visualization. And I was pushing a fifth goal: to enable instruction anytime, any place, to any student on any subject. But I quickly discovered that among research universities, it was one thing to advocate something that could change civilization, but something entirely different to advocate something that could change education as we knew it. In 1988, the obvious starting point for getting greater funding for the NREN in Washington was Al Gore, who was working on a bill. Al Gore's networking vision was of a network connecting everyone. He called this a national information superhighway, and his father had written the bill creating the national superhighway system. So we worried about the difference between Gore's vision of a network connecting everyone and our vision of a scholars network. But then we remembered Mae West's advice: too much of a good thing can be simply wonderful. And we decided that connecting everyone sounded like a good thing. So we threw in with Al, and we worked with Gore and Representative George Brown, chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, providing support on three fronts. We could provide experts on the content of the Gore, on the requirements, content requirements of the Gore bill. And Gore's point person on that effort was Mike Nelson, who had a PhD in geology from MIT. And Mike had come to Washington to learn the difference between a rock and a hard place. And he has appeared on TV lately, quite frequently, discussing how it was that the Egyptians managed to close down the internet in Egypt. And on the second front, we could provide expert witnesses at congressional hearings. And third, we could persuade college and university presidents to call their senator and representative, telling them that if they didn't, that the support of the Gore Bill was critical to the future of research at their institution. And in 1991, the Gore Bill passes. And there was a small party in his office celebrating that event. And I have a picture of Gore at that party with an unindicted co-conspirator. In the early 1990s, new internet applications were created by the university and research communities, including a web browser at CERN and the University of Illinois, archive at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the handle system for digital library objects at CNRI, and Bill Arms had a big hand in that, and the Internet Gopher at the University of Minnesota and CUCME, a conferencing system and bare access at Cornell, which I think you're probably all familiar with, and there were a lot of others. And in 1992, the Internet Society was started. It was created to support the growth and technical evolution of the network of the Internet as a worldwide educational and research infrastructure. The Society internationalized the Internet evolution effort, and Jürgen Harms, Bob Kahn, and I signed papers of incorporation, creating the Society, and appointed the founding board of trustees. And in 1993, responsibility for evolving Internet standards moved to the Internet Society. By 1992, the Internet had spread. It was really NSFNet, had links to universities all over the world, and the international community was disgruntled by the fact that all of the levers of control were in the United States. And here is a picture of the founding board of trustees. And if people ever search for the people guilty of starting the internet, and after fingering Al Gore, they want more, there are people in this picture that would be a good starting point. Seated to my right is Bob Kahn, who started ARPANET, and standing behind him is Vince Cerf, who was a graduate student, wrote TCP/IP, and had been the longtime chair of the Internet Engineering Task Force, which was the group that evolved the evolution of Internet protocols. And to Kahn's right is Jürgen Harms from a university in Switzerland, who was the leader of an internet corporate consortium in Europe. And to my left is Ira Fuchs, who started BitNet. And standing on the far left behind him is Larry Landweber, one of the founders of Computer Science Net. And standing in the back, there were people who had started networking in Japan, the Netherlands, the Balkans, Denmark, and Australia. And there were a couple of people in this picture from the industrial sector who were involved in the Internet Engineering Task Force. And then on the far right is Mike Roberts, who had been our representative on the EDUCOM Networking and Telecommunication Task Force, and now he was involved in supporting the Internet Society, and he went on to become the president of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and ICANN was the group that distributed the Cornell.edu and Amazon.com addresses, and with that distribution, they doled out a block of internet addresses, and there were 4.3 billion of them in 1984, and those addresses will run out by the end of the year. So ISOC is in the middle of a life and death struggle to convert to IP version 6, which has enough internet addresses to carry on after the end of this year. But NREN problems emerge. Students graduated, entered industry, and quickly became unhappy with the loss of tools, information, and contacts that they enjoyed while students. Corporations came to understand that their business depended upon communication, and the one foot on the floor policy was unenforceable. That policy for NSFNet meant that one end of every conversation had to be an academic. So I could talk to anyone in IBM, and anyone in IBM could talk to me, but IBM people couldn't talk to other IBM people using the network. And it got that name because it was a rule in place when I was an undergraduate covering intervisitation between the boys and girls dormitories on Sunday afternoons for 2 hours. It was a different era. In 1993, Al Gore is the vice president and presses his vision of the network. And the NSF announces that NSFNet will be privatized in April of 1995 to create the internet. And when I got that message, it struck me like a bolt of lightning. This could lead to the end of civilization as we knew it. Review of roles. ARPANET started network-based computer communication systems, passed TCP/IP to CSNET, which resulted in its being used in NSFNet. ARPANET people supported the process for evolving internet standards until 1993, and their role in the history of the internet has been well documented. Al Gore, he was tirelessly involved in promoting the National Information Superhighway at least as early as 1986. His bill fueled the rapid growth of the NREN to become the internet. It appropriated $600 million to that effort. And his vision of a network connecting everyone was realized. Universities. By the time NSFNet was started, networking was already a global university phenomenon, BitNet. And it was the zeal of the university community fired up by academic goals that fueled the explosive worldwide growth of networking. Universities were the laboratory in which internet technology and applications were built and scaled up to work with millions of people connected. University people provided most of the creative energy and did almost all of the work. And universities trained the people who brought the internet into the commercial world. The role of ARPANET has been well documented in the story of the history of the internet, but the role of universities in Al Gore, I believe, has not. Cornell. Many of the people doing supercomputing today got their first experience with parallel computing on the Cornell supercomputer. Cornell people and ex-Cornell people had key leadership roles in the creation and evolution of the NREN. And I'll mention one more. Juris Hartmanis was the leader of the group that oversaw networking in the NSF from 1995 to 97, and he oversaw the transition from NREN to the internet, and he did one hell of a job. Good job. And thank you.
An hour later.
What?
An hour later.
Later.
Okay. I think if you were listening, you could understand why I have long held the feeling that there ought to be a building named for Ken King at Cornell. He really led the way. We are running a little longer than we had intended, but I will keep us in a little longer, and then I'll give you a chance to break if you need to slip out and let it go maybe as long as till 12 o'clock if some want to stay. Question back here.
So what are some of the things that you have seen evolve and you had high hopes for, you had or a vision for a certain direction that have not occurred for a variety of reasons? And can you speak to some of those?
Well,
we know the things that are exciting and that have occurred that are sort of...
Okay, the question is, what things that had hoped for the internet have not been realized. And the first was that I'd hoped that the internet would not have been involved in exporting lots of jobs to the rest of the world from the United States. And the other thing that actually Bob and I have been working on for the last few years is to get more information, academic information, available to scholars on the internet. And I mentioned the goal of being able to provide instruction anytime, any place, to any student on any subject. And that's, well, a fairly dangerous goal, but at large research universities today, there's some universities thinking about videotaping large classes where the student enrollment demand exceeds the size of their classrooms and there's very little interaction between students and faculty, so that students can watch those lectures anytime, any place. So to some extent, I think the nose of the camel is under the tent.
Okay. Yes. And speak loudly.
Well, this may be trivial in terms of networks, but there were problems as a teacher with students wanting to do computer. One of them was Fortran that they had to learn. There was no A to D conversion, and we were living in an analog world. And I don't feel that we got much help centrally by you people developing networks.
Well, the solution to widespread use of computing by students was the arrival of microcomputers. I mean, there was just no way of supporting a large number of students, or for that matter, a large number of faculty on a mainframe computer. In fact, the mainframe computer at Cornell when I arrived probably had 1/1000th of the power of computer right here, and we supported the entire university with that computer. So the technology was just not up to doing an effective job of supporting instruction or, for that matter, research.
Well, it's a real problem for it, and we ended up with dedicated computers in our labs instead of being part of this network.
Cornell implemented something called IT. Instant turnaround, but the students called it infinite turnaround. It's back in the days of batch computing. Anyone else? Comment? Even? Yes?
I'm interested if you're still watching the political scene, what do you think of the administration's suggestion of going to new forms of net identifications and their ability to know who we are?
I think in the internet world today, there are really serious problems about privacy. And extending the arm of the government, in fact, you know, industry tracks your every move on the internet now, mostly. And so it's a serious problem. And I strongly believe that there should be less surveillance and more privacy.
Yes, go.
Yeah. Whatever happened to the young man who put Cornell on the national scene with a notorious worm back in the 70s?
Yes, well, one of the features of Unix used in computer science departments was that it was an easy system to diddle with. And they had a policy of allowing guests to sign on to a remote computer system and enhance it. And Morris, I think, was the person's name.
Morris.
It's Robert Morris.
Okay. And he introduced a worm that brought down the whole internet. And he had done his undergraduate work at Harvard and his graduate work in computer science at Cornell, proving how dangerous a person could be that got their undergraduate training in ethics at Harvard and their graduate training in computer science at Cornell. Well, the last time I heard about him, he was earning lots of money as a security advisor to corporations, but he's now at MIT. Well,
yes.
How did their work at CERN fit in? I mean, you talk to people at CERN, that was the kind of thing that they invented the intent.
Well, Tim Berners-Lee at CERN wrote the original papers defining the requirements of a web browser. But the first useful web browser was Mosaic, which was implemented at the University of Illinois. So the explosive growth of the internet was a result of the availability of web browsers, and Tim Berners-Lee is the father of that effort. But aside from that, CERN connected to NSFNet relatively early, and physicists there were very active on the internet, but I think their seminal input to the internet was by Tim Berners-Lee.
And Ithaca has a connection. Jim Houck, an astronomy's son, Chris, was one of the 10 who created Mosaic at the University of Illinois. Yes, again.
So what about the world of supercomputing today, and how do you see it going?
Well, all of supercomputers today are massively parallel. And I think they're up to petaflops or something like that. I mean, huge. And for those of you who watched Jeopardy last night, a computer called Watson, which I think had 4,000 computers, beat the reigning Jeopardy champions of the past in a Jeopardy match. So all the supercomputers today are massively parallel, and the world's fastest computer today is in China.
Yes, Jim.
Given this very high standard that you started with in education and research, how did the internet come to be taken over by so much trash?
Well, we never wanted to use this phrase, but one of our worries about connecting everyone was that it would enable a lot of what some people called the great unwashed. And a few years ago, someone did a study and found that 63% of the traffic on the internet was pornography, and a relatively high percentage of it came from Finland for some reason. Dark nights, maybe.
So maybe one more question, and then I think Ken could stay a few minutes after we adjourn in case you have additional questions, but I'll not keep you longer than I should. Maybe one more question? Are we finished? Thank you for coming.
Before you go, I just want to take an opportunity to present Ken a token of our appreciation. And Ken, it's really just a token. Here you go.
Uh-huh. And it has the Cornell logo on it.
Thank you, folks.
Thanks.